the rest of us for weeks. And the townspeople? Simple anger wasn't to be expected at this point. Confusion will dominate for a time, perhaps a great deal of time. That will work to our advantage, for there is much to do before our antagonist arrives. And when she does, we may find that popular confusion will give way to something distinctly uglier. The doctor led us over to join the Westons, and then we set out as a group, minus only Mr. Picton, who had a lot of paperwork to take care of, to make sure that the family got home safe. On our drive back to town from the Westons' farm, the doctor told us about what had happened during the grand jury's proceedings. Though an emotional tale, it wasn't a particularly complicated one. Mr. Picton had carefully laid out most of the physical evidence we'd assembled, and then gone on to paint, with Mrs. Louisa Wright's help, a picture of Libby Hatch as a fortune hunter and a libertine. A willful, wanton character who, if she hadn't been directly responsible for her husband's death, had certainly expected that she was going to profit by it. When it had become clear that her children stood in the way of that profit, Mr. Picton had stated flatly Libby had attempted to eliminate them. The doctor told us that Mr. Picton's language had been so persuasive, and, true to Mr. Moore's prediction, so fast and overwhelming, that it had seemed like many members of the jury were convinced of his argument even before Clara Hatch had been called to testify. And when the girl had taken the stand, Mr. Picton had asked her only four questions. Were you in your family's wagon with your mother and your brothers on the night of May 31st, 1894? The answer had been a not-so-easy yes. Did you see anyone else during your ride home? Answer, a firm no. Then you were shot by someone in the wagon. To this, Clara had just nodded. Clara, was that person your mother? A good minute had gone by before the girl could cope with that one, but steady looks of reassurance from the doctor and of love and support from Josiah and Ruth Weston had given her courage, and finally she'd whispered, yes. No one in the hearing room had made a sound as the girl stepped down. The members of the jury, the doctor said, had looked just the same as the crowd outside the courthouse had when they'd gotten the news about the indictment, as if they'd all been hit with one enormous brick. Mr. Picton had wrapped up his business pretty quickly after that, and the jury's assent to an indictment on two counts of first-degree murder and one of attempted murder had been very quick. It wasn't the kind of story what would make anybody overjoyed or triumphant. And to be sure, all of us in the surrey, having seen what the day had done to little Clara, felt a deep sense of regret and sadness as we clattered back to Mr. Picton's house. But underneath said emotions of the moment, for all of us, was something what maybe went even deeper, what you might call an unspoken feeling that we were, as a group, finally on something what my dice-throwing pals downtown would have called a roll. Our investigation, it appeared, had been transformed into a sort of quiet locomotive, and that locomotive was bearing down unstoppably, it seemed, on the woman who'd been committing so much mayhem for so many years. Evidence and testimony, hard won by hard work, were the ropes we were using to strap the golden-eyed killer onto the tracks. True, our responsibilities to Clara, to the Westons, to little Anna, and to our own safety were considerable. But our responsibility to keeping our engine running was the most important of all. And on that Friday evening, we appeared to have a full head of steam, and the way ahead looked good and clear. That was before Marcus came back from Chicago. Chapter 41. The doctor had been right in supposing that the general state of what he called moral confusion, what took hold of Ballston Spa during the days after the indictment of Libby Hatch, would make our work easier. It wasn't that we were suddenly looked on any kindlier by the townsfolk. It was just that they were too busy trying to make sense of the affair and its long, horrible history to pay us much mind. The fact that people like Sheriff Dunning had been so convinced of Libby's guilt by what they'd heard during the grand jury hearing made it impossible for those vexed citizens to just write the upcoming trial off as the work of ungodly troublemakers from New York City. And it was hard for even them what hung on most stubbornly to the tale of the mysterious Negro to get around the fact that an 8-year-old girl who'd suffered years of physical pain and spiritual torment had stood up before a panel of adults and stated flat out that it had been her own mother who'd in fact been the agent of it all. Libby Hatch, or as she was labeled in the grand jury indictment, Mrs. Elspeth Hunter, was arrested at No. 39 Bethune Street in New York on Tuesday afternoon. Sheriff Dunning had gotten in touch with the New York City police on Friday and had been referred to the Bureau of Detectives. Together with officers of the 9th Precinct, the Bureau had put Mrs. Hunter under surveillance right away and reported that she didn't seem to be making any moves toward beating it out of town. During the time they were watching her, the city cops apparently didn't experience any interference from the dusters, which we took as a further demonstration that Libby didn't intend to avoid capture. Sheriff Dunning directed the 9th's detectives not to make any moves toward actually arresting the woman before his arrival, unless it suddenly started to look like she was going to bolt. Then, on Monday, he took the train down to the city with two of his deputies. This slightly leisurely way of going about capturing a murderess had those of us on the doctor's team a little confused, but Mr. Picton explained that the longer we delayed Libby Hatch's arrival in Ballston Spa, the longer we could take advantage of the eerie, spooked calm what had descended on the town. So, when he saw Sheriff Dunning and his boys off at the train depot, he didn't urge them to go about their business too hastily, an instruction what Dunning took to mean that he and his deputies were free to enjoy a night in the big city before returning home with their prisoner. They were met at Grand Central Terminal by a couple of the detectives from the Bureau, who proceeded to take them down to the 9th Precinct Station House on Charles Street. Being unaware that any New York City detectives had been involved in Mr. Picton's investigation, Sheriff Dunning spared himself the cold reception he almost definitely would have received if he'd dropped the Isaacsons' names. Together, the lawmen decided to wait until Tuesday morning to actually clap the irons on Mrs. Hunter, and we were left to imagine what the sheriff and his deputies got up to that night, since it would have been tough to come up with anybody better suited to showing them a good time in the big city than the men of the 9th. The fact that Dunning waited until Tuesday afternoon to pinch Mrs. Hunter seemed proof positive that he and his boys had taken full advantage of the cultural resources of New York. But as things worked out, a hangover wouldn't have been much of a disadvantage to them on Tuesday. When they arrived at Bethune Street, they found Mrs. Hunter packed and ready to go, almost, Sheriff Dunning told Mr. Picton when he called from Grand Central Terminal before boarding the train north, like she was anxious for the trial to begin. Dunning went on to report that, barring delays, he and his deputies would be arriving with their prisoner at midnight. All through that Tuesday, the citizens of Ballston Spa had continued to stew over what Mr. Moore, true to form, insisted on calling the moral implications of the case. They had no choice but to stick with that activity on into the evening, as everyone began to anticipate Libby's return in irons. In fact, it was starting to feel like brooding would keep the town occupied indefinitely, or at least until somebody came up with an explanation for the killings, what would let their society, which if it hadn't actually produced Libby Hatch had certainly believed her lies, off the hook. Of course, if they'd known that one of the only men in the entire country who was capable of coming up with such an explanation was at that point packing his bags in Chicago and getting ready to journey to their town, their mood might have been considerably different. But fortunately for us, the only person who was as yet aware of the movements of Mr. Clarence Darrow was Marcus. And late on Tuesday afternoon, he returned from Chicago in advance of the mysterious Midwestern lawyer. After exchanging warm greetings with the rest of our group at the depot, Marcus handed me his suitcase, which El Nino immediately grabbed, refusing to allow me to carry it, and then we all started walking up Bath Street toward the courthouse. We'd been ordered to bring the detective sergeant to said building just as soon as his train got in, being as even though Mr. Picton had many pressing matters to attend to in his office, the trial was slated to open on the following Tuesday, August 3rd, he said there was nothing more important than learning about the background and tactics of the hired legal gun who was being brought in from so far away to face him. I figured that Marcus could have done with a hot bath and a good meal after his long journey, but orders were orders. Besides, the discoveries that Marcus had made about Mr. Darrow were such that he himself was very anxious to share them with the rest of us. Because of this, the doctor had cut his day with Clara Hatch short—he was still working with her as hard as ever— and joined us at the train station, ready to give Marcus his own version of the third degree, a version what included a box of the doctor's best custom-rolled smokes instead of bright lights, and a flask of Mr. Picton's excellent whiskey in place of brass knuckles. Once settled into the big old leather chair in Mr. Picton's office, whiskey in one hand and a cigarette in the other, Marcus began his report. The vital statistics were easy enough to lay hands on, or at least most of them were, he said, taking a drink from the flask, setting it aside, and pulling out a small notebook. He's either 39 or 40. I couldn't get the exact date of birth. Parents, a Unitarian minister who gave up the pulpit to become a furniture maker, and a New England suffragist. He seems to take after the father for the most part. The old man never lost the crusading spirit. Darrow himself has had a lifelong fascination with Darwin, Spencer, Thomas Huxley, considers himself quite a rationalist. Oh, and he knows about your work, too, Dr. Kreitzler.
Does he? The doctor asked, surprised.
And how did you find that out?
I asked him, Marcus answered simply. Got in to see him yesterday evening, told him I was a publisher from New York who wanted him to defend an anarchist who's up for building bombs in New York. The last part of the story is true, too. You remember Jochen Dietrich, Lucius? That idiot downtown who kept blowing up tenements because he couldn't get his timing devices to work?
Oh, yes, Lucius said, recalling the name. The 7th Precinct boys picked him up just before we left town, didn't they?
That's right, Marcus answered, slowly running one of his big hands through his thick black hair and then rubbing his tired brown eyes.
Anyway, one of the Chicago cops I talked to said that Darrow's got a soft spot for anarchists. Fancies himself to be a bit of one, intellectually. So he agreed to see me. Marcus shook his head and took a big drag off of his cigarette. He's a strange sort of character, not at all what you'd expect from a man who's made a pretty decent living off the corporate payroll. He seems to have a careless attitude toward his appearance. Clothes are slightly rumpled, hair's cut rough and hangs in his face. But there's something very self-conscious about it all, calculated even. It's like he's trying to play the homespun hero, the plain prairie lawyer. His style of speaking's the same. He's got the outward manner of the lonely cynic, but he makes sure you can hear the heart of an idealistic romantic, too. Just how much of it's genuine or which parts, I certainly couldn't tell you. Marcus flipped a page in his notebook. There's some other minor details. He's a baseball fanatic. And an agnostic.
Well, of course he's an agnostic, Mr. Picton said. He's a defense lawyer. There's only room for one supreme savior in this world, and defense lawyers like to play that role themselves.
Now, Rupert, Mr. Moore scolded, don't be bitter. He likes Russian literature, poetry and philosophy, too, Marcus went on. He has a sort of salon of like-minded souls out there, reads aloud to them at their little gatherings. All in all, a very theatrical and very manipulative character for all his talk about social justice. Even his own people say so. I talked to a woman who's a partner in his firm.
He's got a woman in his firm? Miss Howard said. An actual partner?
That's right, Marcus answered.
Just to show off to his suffragist friends? Miss Howard continued. Or does she actually do something?
Actually, that's the interesting part, Marcus answered. He's not much of an advocate of women's rights himself, doesn't really consider them an oppressed part of society, not like, say, labor men or blacks.
Well, the doctor said, perhaps we'll be spared the usual lectures on maternal sanctity, then.
Oh, I think we will, Marcus replied quickly. But I think what he'll come at us with instead will be more dangerous, much more dangerous.
Taking a pull off the flask, Marcus hissed and turned to our host.
Mr. Picton, how much of a history were you able to compile on Darrow?
I found a piece on the Debs trial, Mr. Picton answered with a shrug. It mentioned his background with the railway, but there wasn't much more than that.
Nothing on the Prendergast case? Marcus asked.
The Prendergast case? Mr. Picton said, sitting bolt upright. Great jumping cats. Was he involved in that?
I'm afraid so, Marcus answered. Heavily involved.
Well, Mr. Picton said. I assume you remember the affair, Doctor?
The doctor was already nodding gloomily. Indeed, a more ludicrous example of perverting justice to please the public has rarely been seen.
Marcus laughed a bit. Oddly enough, Doctor, that's exactly how Darrow saw it.
Mr. Moore was trying hard to catch up, knocking a fist against his head. "Prendergast, Prendergast." His face lit up. "Not the fellow who shot the mayor of Chicago."
"The same," Marcus answered. "On the last day of the exposition of 1893, the first assassination in the city's history, Eugene Patrick Prendergast turned himself in along with a $4 revolver and claimed that he'd killed Mayor Carter Harrison because his honor hadn't lived up to a pledge to put Prendergast in charge of building the city's new elevated track lines. The claim was a fantasy, of course, and the man was obviously a lunatic. But, well, Harrison had been shot at the exposition, which made for some very bad international press."
"And so the state of Illinois," the doctor continued bitterly, looking at those of us who didn't already know the story, "decided to entrust the assessment of his sanity to the chief physician of the Cook County Jail, a man with no special training in mental pathologies. Yet even this hand-picked flunky had absolutely no trouble declaring that Prendergast was a raging psychotic."
"Not that it mattered," Mr. Picton finished. "Prendergast was quickly declared sane by a jury. He was sentenced to hang, and he did hang, didn't he, detective?"
"There's more to the story than that," Marcus answered. "After the conclusion of the first trial, Darrow, whose personal opposition to the death penalty has always been almost fanatical, offered to help Prendergast's lawyer try to get a new sanity hearing. This second proceeding began on January 20th of 94, and it was very revealing, especially for our purposes." Flipping further through his notes, Marcus took another pull from the flask. "Darrow took the lead in arguing the defense's case, and his tactics, according to several people who witnessed them, represented a whole new kind of lawyering. From the start, he shifted the focus off of Prendergast and onto the jury. He told them that the prosecution was asking them to violate their sacred oath to weigh the case on its merits in order to satisfy society's desire for revenge. Now, word had gotten around that Darrow was an expert at manipulating juries, so this group was at least somewhat ready for him. But it turned out that he knew they'd been prepared, and instead of crying foul, he used that fact to his advantage. In his opening remarks, he addressed the rumors that he was going to try to bamboozle them with a lot of technicalities and theatrics. He solemnly pledged that he wouldn't, because if he tried such trickery and failed, he said, the responsibility, and that's a key ploy in Darrow's arguments, responsibility for Prendergast's death would rest with him. And he refused, he said, in his plain-spoken, humble way, to assume such a moral burden. So he promised that he'd be perfectly straightforward in his arguments, and if the jury decided that his honest attempts weren't good enough, the responsibility for sending a lunatic to his death would rest with them, not him."
"Clever," Mr. Picton said, smiling slowly. "Very clever."
"And complete nonsense, of course," Marcus added. "I mean, in reality, he used every trick he could think of during the trial. He wept, actually wept, over the dead mayor and the cruelty of a world that could produce a creature like Prendergast, and he begged the jury to let their humanity prevail. And most importantly, so far as we're concerned, he went after the prosecution team personally. He turned what was supposed to be the trial of an assassin into an eloquent, sarcastic, the man has wit, there's no doubting that, and relentless examination of the motives of the state and its men in prosecuting lunatics, even murderous lunatics. Any unlucky soul the prosecutors called as a witness was badgered and tainted with whatever kind of suspicion Darrow could dream up, so that the questioning became about them and their beliefs, not about Prendergast. By arguing constantly in the negative instead of advocating his client's cause, he turned the whole trial topsy-turvy." I turned to look at the doctor, who was staring at the floor and pulling at the patch of hair under his lower lip.
"But it didn't work," he said.
"No, not in the end," Marcus answered. "The jury withstood the pressure and upheld the earlier sanity verdict. But the important thing is that he made a close race out of what looked like it was going to be the pure and simple railroading of a lunatic." The doctor sat back and sighed.
"Unfortunate methods," he judged quietly. "But I can't say that I disapprove of his goal. Maybe not in that case, Marcus said. But if I'm right about what he'll try to do here, you may feel differently, Doctor.
Yes, the doctor answered with a small smile. I suspect you're right, Marcus.
I don't understand, Lucius said. What can he try to do here? I mean, he can certainly find forensics experts who will argue our findings, and maybe even personal acquaintances of Mrs. Hatch's who will disagree with our interpretation of her motives. But what about Clara? How can he argue with an eyewitness?
By attacking the man who's behind the eyewitness, Marcus said, still looking to the doctor. Or at least the man he'll paint as being behind her.
Yes, Mr. Picton said. I beg you to get your point, Detective. And we can't depend on Clara's testimony alone to fend off such an attack. Young children, especially if they're as fragile as Clara, are not the most reliable witnesses. They're too easy to bully or cajole. That's why it's been so important that the doctor continue working with Clara so that she can learn to provide detailed explanations of her story that won't fall to pieces the first time the defense goes after her.
The point is, Marcus continued, our roles will, in a very strange but potentially damaging way, be reversed in this trial. Darrow will be arguing the negative, knowing that no one wants to believe what we're saying about Libby Hatch, and it will be up to us to advocate our cause. As you've surmised, Doctor, the man's not going to come in with a lot of pious arguments about the sanctity of womanhood and maternity. He's going to attack, not defend, and try to get us back on our heels before we know what's happening. And the logical place to start any attack is at the weak point, which, in the public mind, I'm afraid, is me, the doctor finished for him. Refilling his pipe from a pouch in his pocket, Mr. Picton struck a match on his chair as the rest of us pondered that. So, he said, firing up his pipe and showing that enthusiasm in the face of trouble what was his best quality. The question becomes, how do we defend against such a line of attack, and thereby preserve the integrity of Clara's testimony? Drawing hard on his pipe, Mr. Picton considered the matter for a moment. I had hoped, as you know, to keep any discussion of psychological theory to a minimum in this case, Doctor. But if Darrow attacks with it, you must be prepared to strike back. In kind, and with the superior force which you, as an expert, possess. The doctor stood up, pacing slowly in what little free floor space the room offered.
It is not a position with which I am unfamiliar, he said, rubbing his bad arm. Though I confess that I hoped taking this case would mean that for once I'd be on the offensive. Perhaps that is destined never to happen.
Oh, but it must happen, Mr. Picton bellowed, gripping his pipe and swinging it through the air. That's just what I mean about you striking back. I don't want you to defend yourself from behind an intellectual barricade. I want to see you counterattack on the open field of ideas, where the jury can see you. Draw blood from this man, first blood, if you can. To back you up, I'll go over every shred of personal information about Darrow that Marcus has been able to assemble, and I won't hesitate to use it. We are not going to let this trial get away from us. Mr. Picton banged a fist on his desk hard. Darrow may represent some new breed of lawyer, but damn it all, we'll match him trick for trick.
Señor Doctor,
El Niño, who'd been sitting cross-legged on the floor, got up to approach the doctor with cautious respect.
This man, he is dangerous to you? You wish El Niño to kill him?
The statement, coming at the somewhat difficult moment it did, served admirably to break the thickening ice. After staring at the Aborigine in amazement for a few seconds, we all began to laugh out loud, and the doctor put his right arm around his small defender's shoulders.
No, El Niño, he said, the man is not a danger in that way. He does not intend to injure me physically.
But if he is to interfere with finding baby Anna,
El Niño said, smiling at our laughter without really knowing what it was about,
then we should kill him, yes?
I think, Miss Howard said, getting up and moving over to the doctor and the Aborigine, that this may be the moment to call a break for dinner. Let's go, El Niño. On the way home, I'll try to explain to you why killing this man is not the best way to deal with the situation. As she guided El Niño to the door, Miss Howard cocked her head, assuming, of course, that it really isn't. As the Isaacsons followed the other two out of the office, Mr. Moore, Cyrus, and I went up to the doctor.
You going to be all right with all this, Laszlo? Mr. Moore said.
It's not myself I'm worried about, the doctor answered. It's Clara. This trial was already going to be excruciating for her. But now to be targeted by a lawyer who uses the kind of tactics Marcus has told us about. Still, he went on, throwing his hands up with a sigh, I suppose I'll just have to make that much more certain that I prepare her adequately, as long as she doesn't encounter her mother before giving testimony. I think she'll have a fighting chance at coming through it well, or at least intact.
What about it, Rupert? Mr. Moore said to Mr. Picton, who was stuffing a batch of files into a soft leather briefcase to take home with him. Is Judge Brown the type we can count on to post a reasonably high bail in a case like this?
I hate to try to predict anything about Judge Brown, Mr. Picton answered. But the brilliant Mr. Darrow is not yet here, and apparently someone has retained Irving W. Maxson to be Libby's local counsel. Maxson's quite good and has a lot of connections down in the city, but I don't think he'll be able to win an argument for moderate bail on his own. Remember, though, if Vanderbilt is secretly bankrolling this thing, we can't safely assume that any bail, however high, would be prohibitive. I'll have to go for an out-and-out denial, and that's never a certainty. And then there's the question of the arraignment and the plea tomorrow.
What about them, sir? Cyrus asked, puzzled.
Well, Cyrus, Mr. Picton answered, fastening his case and then looking up, if Darrow should get here before the arraignment, there's always the possibility that he'll try to balance his personal books by entering another insanity plea, redress the wrong of the Prendergast case by getting Libby Hatch freed on the basis of mental incompetence, that sort of thing. Lawyers carry grudges like everyone else, maybe even more. I'm not worried about my end of the matter so far as that goes. I have enough motives and scheming on Libby's part to demonstrate cold premeditation. But it's another area where he might go after you, Doctor. Can you successfully argue that a woman who has killed her own children can nonetheless be mentally sound?
The doctor breathed deeply. I should feel more confident, of course, if we discovered more details of her youth. On a hypothetical basis, it becomes much harder. Still, there are precedents, and as you say, Mr. Picton, the presence of cold, even clever premeditation eliminates the possibility of any clearly demonstrable mental pathology, such as dementia praecox, or of any sufficiently severe brain trauma. To argue that she was mad, Darrow would have to return to the idea of moral insanity, the notion that a person can be morally but not intellectually deranged. It's a concept that has been almost universally repudiated. Then, too, there's always the chance that our diligent workers—here he gave my hair a tousle—will manage to find out more about the woman's past before the trial begins.
Well, then, Mr. Picton said, snatching up his briefcase, we have cause for cautious optimism, particularly, I will say, when you consider our position at the moment. The woman's in custody, she's on her way here, and she's going to stand trial. I confess that I wasn't at all sure we'd ever get this far, so let's not sink into pessimism. It's bad for the appetite, and Mrs. Hastings will have been cooking all afternoon. Mustn't disappoint her.
With our host continuing to encourage us, we wandered out into the hallway, there joining the others for the walk down the marble stairs to the first floor of the courthouse. Mr. Picton paused to make sure that the guard Henry had prepared one of the cells in the basement. Libby Hatch would be spending at least one night in jail, since her arraignment wasn't scheduled to take place till the next day. The guard said that yes, one of the cells was ready, and then we all began to file outside for the walk down High Street. Just before passing through the front door, I stopped and looked around at the big stone chamber, what was lit up by the soft, straw-colored light of a July evening.
"What is it, Stevie?" Mr. Picton said, noticing me pause. I shrugged. Last time we'll see it this quiet for a while, I guess, I said. Gonna be a lot of action after tomorrow.
And provided we can get bail denied, Mr. Picton answered with a nod, there'll be a new tenant for the next couple of weeks, at any rate.
Henry won't like that. None of the guards will. Hey, Henry?
Mr. Picton smiled as he taunted the men. You boys will actually have something to do for a change. Chuckling to himself, Mr. Picton clamped his pipe in his mouth and headed outside. And just as I followed, I saw a gleam of resentment enter the guard's eyes. We all talked and laughed a lot at dinner, though not much was said about the case. It was as if, knowing what was scheduled to happen later that night, we didn't want to put a hex on things by acting as if Libby Hatch was already safely arrived and locked up in her cell. Mr. Moore went into a bit of a fit halfway through the meal when he realized the date, July 27th, which meant that he'd missed the opening day of the season at the Saratoga Racing Association. In an attempt to make him feel better, Miss Howard suggested a game of poker after dinner. This seemed to fill the bill, not only for the purposes of getting Mr. Moore to stop whining, but also for taking our minds off of more pressing concerns. Heading into the reception room after we'd laid waste to one of Mrs. Hastings' excellent pies, everyone except Cyrus and Lucius gathered around the card table. The younger Isaacson brother was too nervous to sit still for cards, while Cyrus preferred to pass the time playing Mr. Picton's piano. The rest of us, though, threw ourselves into our small-stakes gambling with genuine enthusiasm. The contest grew pretty heated as the evening wore on, and it wasn't until Mrs. Hastings came down from her room to tell us that we needed to get going if we wanted to be sure of meeting the midnight train that we realized how late it had gotten. When we did, I think everybody's heart did a kind of fluttering jig. At least there was a lot of pointless running around what preceded our actually getting out the door, the kind of activity that generally marks people who've reached some long-dreamed-of but still, in a way, unexpected point. Our walk down to the depot was quiet enough, but I marked that there were a lot of faces and a lot of dimly lit windows watching as we passed. A very unusual state of affairs in a town that, as I've said, generally bedded down early. It wasn't hard to explain the unusual behavior. The feeling that the whole community was on the eve of something that might change the way they thought about a lot of things, not least themselves, was thicker than it had been at any point during the previous 5 days. Thicker even than when Mr. Picton had announced the indictment. And when we first heard the distant whistle of the midnight train echoing up from many miles to the southeast, I was sure that we couldn't have been the only people in town who felt our bodies shiver mightily. There were only a few other people on the train platform when we got there. The guard, Henry, who'd been told by Sheriff Dunning to meet the train, along with Mr. Groves of the Boston Weekly Journal and a couple of his employees. As for the mayor of the town, he'd been on vacation since before we came to the place, and after hearing about the indictment, he'd decided to extend his holiday. Like District Attorney Pearson, he figured there was no political gain to be had from this case, only damage, and maybe considerable damage. Mr. Groves didn't say much to any of our party, and Mr. Picton didn't offer him anything fresh for his newspaper. Not that Mr. Groves would have printed such. In fact, I think he was just there on the off chance that Dunning would show up empty-handed, or that a calamity of some kind might take place at the depot. My bet was that if everything went smoothly, the evening's activities wouldn't get more than a few lines in the following Saturday's edition of the weekly paper. Midnight came and went, causing Mr. Picton to remark that he hoped the Spanish government and people were even worse at keeping to timetables than Americans were, if our country really intended to go to war with Madrid. Finally, at about 12:15, the train's whistle sounded again, much closer this time. El Niño hopped down and did the old Indian trick of putting his ear to the tracks, then nodded eagerly as he rejoined us on the platform. The actual noise of the train's engine reached our ears just as a light flashed through a break in the buildings beyond the depot. And in a few more seconds, the steaming locomotive and its four nearly empty cars stormed in, causing us all to take a few steps back toward the station. Sheriff Dunning was the first man off the forward car, and even in the near darkness his face looked plainly exhausted. One of his deputies followed, and then there was a long pause. Finally, she appeared. The very shapely body was draped in a fine black silk dress, a stiff crinoline undergarment keeping the skirt in perfect order. The hands were cuffed together with old-style manacles. A small hat with a jet-black rooster feather sat forward on the head, holding a black veil in place. But the weave of the veil was an open one, and the golden eyes were plainly visible as they caught the light of the gas lantern on the platform and threw it back in our faces. "Well," Libby Hatch said, just the same way she had the first time we'd ever heard her speak. in a tone what was open to a half-dozen interpretations, and what made me think of Miss Howard's words about Libby's personality being broken into pieces. Then, seeing past us to Mr. Groves and the others, Libby put on a more melancholy air.
"Mr. Picton,"
she said, slowly coming down the steps of the car and getting a hand from Sheriff Dunning,
"I never expected to see you again, certainly not under such circumstances as these."
"Really?" Mr. Picton said quietly, not able to keep a small grin off his face. "How odd, since I always suspected we might meet again, and under precisely these circumstances." The golden eyes flashed on the rest of us with a quick glare of hate, and then softened as they came to rest on Mr. Groves.
"Is that you, Mr. Groves?"
"Yes, Mrs. Hatch," the man answered, a little surprised. "You remember me?"
"We only met once or twice," Libby answered with a gentle little nod, "but of course I remember."
Golden tears began to well up under the veil.
"How is my baby, my Clara? They tell me she can finally speak again, but I can't believe that she'd...
Her shoulders began to heave, and the sound of gentle sobbing escaped her tightly pursed mouth. Mr. Groves, who looked very confused, but very emotional, too, was about to answer, but the doctor stepped between them quickly. "Mr. Picton," he said, quietly but firmly, "may I suggest—" "Of course," Mr. Picton answered, getting the point right away. "Dunning, you and I will take Mrs. Hunter, as she is now known, to the courthouse. There's a cell waiting. You brought a rig, Henry?" The guard, who also seemed moved by what he'd seen, stepped forward.
"Yes, sir," he said.
"Then we'll be on our way, madam," Mr. Picton finished, indicating the station yard. "If you wish to speak to the press, or they to you, requests can be submitted to my office." Sheriff Dunning got behind the woman.
"Come along, ma'am," he said. "Best to do what Mr. Picton says."
Libby Hatch kept sobbing for a few more seconds, but when she saw that it wasn't going to buy her anything, she turned on the doctor, the sadness disappearing with frightening speed.
"This is your doing, doctor. Don't think I don't know that. But I don't care what you've said to my daughter or made her believe. Once she sees me, she'll know what to do. I'm her mother."
Mr. Picton took a firm hold of Libby's right arm and indicated to Sheriff Dunning that he should do the same on her left. Together they got her moving.
"Do you hear me, doctor?" she called over her shoulder. "I'm her mother. I know that doesn't mean anything to you, but it will to her and to anyone with a heart. Whatever else you may have done, you can't change that."
Sobbing again, the woman passed out into the yard with her escort, the deputies and the courthouse guard following behind. The rest of us wandered out to watch them all get aboard a big plain wagon with three bench seats what was drawn by two horses. With its lone female occupant still in tears, the rig rolled away, and as it did, Mr. Groves turned to give the doctor a silent scowl. Then he nodded to his people and turned to silently march off toward the low end of Bath Street, where the offices of the Journal were located.
"Well, Kreitzler," Mr. Moore said as we stood there in the silent yard, "I guess that's really the question, isn't it?"
The doctor turned to him, his mind very far away.
"The question?"
he asked softly.
"She's Clara's mother," Mr. Moore said, with a grim but curious look on his face. "Can you change that?"
The doctor just shook his head, his eyes going wide.
"No. But we may, perhaps, be able to change what that means."
Chapter 42. The arraignment was set for 10 o'clock the next morning, and by 15 minutes to the hour we were all gathered in the main courtroom. Mr. Picton was seated at one long table on the right side of the big chamber, beyond a low carved oak railing what separated the gallery from the officers of the court. At a similar job on the left-hand side of the room were Libby Hatch and a well-dressed, dark-haired man who wore gold-rimmed pince-nez perched on top of his long, thin nose. No fancy glasses or expensive suit, though, could keep a look of genuine uncertainty out of Irving W. Maxson's eyes. He kept glancing around the room like a nervous bird, as if he wasn't sure how he'd landed in his current predicament or just what he was supposed to do about it. Libby Hatch, on the other hand, still wearing her black silk dress but not the hat or veil, was a picture of confidence staring at the high fruit-wood bench in front of her with a face what seemed forever on the verge of breaking into the coquettish smile it so often displayed. As for Mr. Picton, he had his watch open on the table in front of him and was staring at it, more calm than he'd been at any time since we'd met him. The doctor, Mr. Moore, the detective sergeants, and Miss Howard were all sitting in the first row of gallery chairs behind Mr. Picton's table and the wooden railing. Cyrus, El Niño, and I were right behind him. We'd gotten the Aborigines scrubbed down pretty good for the event, and the combination of his cleanliness and my evening clothes made him one of the most presentable people in the galleries, which since 9 o'clock had been crammed full of a ragtag collection of townspeople, along with some sharper-looking visitors who'd come down from Saratoga. Sheriff Dunning was sitting at a small table just to the right of Mr. Picton, and beyond him, against the right-hand wall, was the jury box, its 12 seats empty. There was a guard standing on the other side of the room, and in front of him was the court stenographer, a proper-looking lady who went by the peculiar name of Iphigenia Blaylock. The bailiff's desk in front of the bench was empty, and on either side of the bench itself were two iron lamp fixtures and a like number of flags, one the American, the other the state banner of New York. Back by the front door, keeping a careful eye on who came into and out of the place and how they behaved, were the guard, Henry, and a slightly shorter, but to judge by the look of him no less powerful, uniformed man. It was a strange experience for me to be observing all the details of the situation from some place other than the defendant's chair. But the strangeness soon gave way to a feeling of relief and even excitement as I realized that this was the place where all our recent labors would reach some kind of a conclusion in the days to come. It was like standing under the wire at the track and waiting for the horses to get out of the starter's gate. I found myself tapping and banging my feet and hands and wishing the thing would just start. To judge by the noises around me, I wasn't alone in said feeling either. The talking, mumbling, and skittish laughing in the courtroom rose as every second of waiting went by until by 3 minutes to 10 I found I almost had to yell to make myself heard by Mr. Moore. "What?" he called back to me, touching his ear. "I said, have you heard anything from Canfield's about the odds?" I shouted back. He nodded. 50-1, and I'm sure it'd be higher if someone other than Rupert were arguing the state's case." I whistled, glancing at the floor. Then, as an idea hit me, I looked back up. "You don't suppose we could get any bets down through a third party, do you?" Mr. Moore smiled, but shook his head. "I already thought of that, but I promised Rupert we wouldn't. He's superstitious, thinks it'll put the Jonah on his chances." I smiled back and nodded. Any gambling soul would have understood exactly how Mr. Picton felt. Just then a door in the back wall of the big room opened, and the bailiff walked in, looking like he was ready to take on any and every person in the room what might have thoughts about trying to turn his court into a circus. He was another big fellow, was Jack Coffey, with the kind of steely eyes which you might have expected to find in a frontier barroom instead of an eastern courthouse. But when I caught sight of Judge Brown, I began to understand why he'd retained the services of such a beefy bailiff. So small he almost disappeared behind the bench as he walked up the little flight of stairs to take his seat behind it, Charles H. Brown had big ears what stuck out like a monkey's, a short but full dusting of pure white hair over his head, and plenty of wrinkles in his aged, clean-shaven face. But his eyes matched the bailiff's in their determination and their open warning that he would put up with absolutely no nonsense, while the firm set of his thin, wrinkled lips and square jaw told of just how much justice he'd dealt out over his years. I was even more glad, looking at him, that it wasn't me sitting in Libby Hatch's chair. "All rise," boomed Bailiff Coffey from deep in his barrel chest, bringing everyone to their feet and instant silence to the room. And as he went on to announce the exact number of that session of the court, he kept glancing up at the crowd, still looking for some wise mug what might think he wasn't in the presence of the full power of the state of New York. Holding a clipboard up in front of him, Coffey next announced the first order of business for that day. "The people of Saratoga County versus Mrs. Elspeth Hunter of New York City, formerly Mrs. Elspeth Hatch of Ballston Spa, formerly Miss Elspeth Fraser of Stillwater, on the charge that she did on or about the 31st day of May, 1894, willfully and with premeditation, murder Thomas Hatch, 3 years old, and Matthew Hatch, 4 years old, and that at the same time she did willfully and with premeditation attempt to murder Clara Hatch, 5 years old, all in the township of Ballston Spa.
The charge sent a ripple of mumbling through the room, one what Judge Brown brought to an end with a sudden, savage rap of his gavel. From his cushioned leather chair, which, high as it was, still only raised him clear of the bench from the chest up, Judge Brown scowled around the courtroom.
"The court," he eventually said, in a tough, gravelly voice, "would like to make it clear from the start that it is aware of the amount of interest the public takes in this case. But the court has never allowed public interest to interfere with the pursuit of justice. And it is not about to start at this late date. I would therefore remind those of you in the galleries that you are the guests of this court, and warn you that if you behave as anything else, you will feel the court's boot in your collective backside."
There were a lot of smiles at that, but only one man at the back of the room actually threw out a laugh, and he soon regretted taking the liberty. Judge Brown's eyes fixed on the fellow quicker than spit as his wrinkled, thin hand brought the gavel up and pointed it.
"Remove that individual," the judge said, "and make certain he does not again attend these proceedings."
The guard, Henry, grabbed the man by the collar and, before the stunned victim had a chance to protest, got him out through the big mahogany doors.
"Now then," the judge went on, looking around to be sure he'd made his point, "is the accused present?"
"She is, Your Honor," replied Irving W. Maxson, his voice a little shaky.
"You have heard the state's charge," the judge went on, looking to Libby Hatch. "How do you plead?"
"If it please the court," Mr. Maxson answered, before Libby could say anything, "we beg a few moments' indulgence as we are awaiting—"
Judge Brown cut him off with a big loud sigh, one what turned into a groan as he rubbed a hand over the short white hairs on his head.
"We are all of us awaiting something, Counselor. I myself have spent my life awaiting a trial that is free of unnecessary delays."
The old eyes bore in on Mr. Maxson.
"I am still awaiting."
"Yes, Your Honor," Mr. Maxson replied, his nervousness growing under the ancient stare what showered down from the bench. "If you'll only allow me to explain—"
Just then the gentle clap of the mahogany doors closing was heard, and Mr. Maxson turned along with the rest of us to get a look at the newcomer who'd produced the sound. Even from a distance, I could tell that it had to be Clarence Darrow, being as he so completely matched Marcus's description of the man. Unlike Lawyer Maxson, Mr. Darrow's clothes were of an ordinary variety, just a plain light brown suit and white shirt, with a simple tie knotted carelessly at the neck, and they looked as if he'd slept in them on the train. Though not as thoroughly sloppy as it would one day become— Mr. Darrow had only begun to establish a disheveled appearance as one of his trademarks— this look was still very different from that of the other officers of the court, as was his way of walking, slow and stooped over, a kind of loping movement, what was especially noticeable given his considerable size. His hair, as Marcus had told us, was uncombed, and a lock of it hung over his forehead. The face wasn't as wrinkled, naturally, as it would become during his years of greater fame, but it was still weathered and rugged, and the eyes had the same light color and sad, searching expression that would also become so legendary in the future. The soft mouth was pursed in a way what matched a pair of big circles under the eyes, a way what seemed to speak about the high price of wisdom bought by too much exposure to man's inhumanity to his fellow man. As he moved down the center aisle, Mr. Darrow took in the crowd with a steady, strong gaze, what was different from Judge Brown's, but produced just as much of an effect. By the time he'd reached the railing, every eye in the place was locked on him. It was a performance, of course, but I'd been in a lot of courtrooms, and it was one of the best I'd ever seen. Good enough to let me know right away that we were in more trouble than we'd figured on being. Clutching an old, beaten-up briefcase, Mr. Darrow signaled to Mr. Maxson, who said, "If the court will excuse me for one moment," and rushed over. Judge Brown didn't look happy about that, but he sat back with another sigh and waited as Mr. Maxson opened the railing of the gate and let Mr. Darrow over into the business side of the room, where he quickly shook hands with Libby Hatch.
"If it please the court," Mr. Maxson said, smiling now.
"It does not please the court, Counselor," Judge Brown said, sitting forward again. "Just what are you about, sir?"
"Your Honor," Mr. Maxson went on quickly, "I should like to introduce Mr. Clarence Darrow, attorney at law from the state of Illinois." "It is the defense's request that the court allow him to appear pro hac vice as the defendant's primary counsel."
"Darrow, eh?" Judge Brown said. "Yes, I've had some communications about you, Mr. Darrow, from downstate."
Mr. Darrow smiled humbly and chuckled.
"I hope," he said, in a deep, soothing sort of voice, "that those communications haven't prejudiced Your Honor against me."
The people in the galleries liked that, and so, in his own way, did Judge Brown.
"It certainly doesn't help," he said, producing some chuckles in the crowd that he let go. "If the defendant wishes to retain out-of-state counsel, that is her prerogative. But this court does not require advice from anyone in New York City on how to conduct its affairs."
"I understand, Your Honor," Mr. Darrow answered, smiling in a way what I had to admit was charming. "We feel the same way about New York City and Chicago."
The crowd laughed again, but got the gavel and a scowl for it. "If it is the defendant's true request," the judge said, turning to the defense table again, "then the court will be pleased to allow Mr. Darrow to practice in this state pro hac vice."
The judge then looked to Libby Hatch, who stood up and widened her glowing eyes innocently.
"I'm sorry, Your Honor," she said, her lips curling up a little as she did. "I'm afraid I never had any Latin."
Little whispers to the effect of, "Me neither," and, "Well, of course you didn't," circulated through the crowd, bringing another rap of the gavel.
"Pro hac vice," the judge explained, as gently as I'd guess he was capable of, "simply means for this occasion, Mrs. Hunter. It grants Mr. Darrow the right to practice in New York, but only for this case. Is that your wish?"
Libby nodded gently, then sat back down.
"And does the state have any objection?" the judge asked.
Mr. Picton smiled gamely, tucked his thumbs into the vest of the crisp gray suit he was wearing, and stood up.
"Not at all, Your Honor," he said, moving out beside his table and seeming even shorter, more wiry, and quicker up against Mr. Darrow. "The court knows of Mr. Darrow by reputation, and if the defense contends that adequate counsel cannot be found in Saratoga County, then while we may not share their assessment of our native talent, neither can we think of any reason why Mr. Darrow should not be permitted to serve."
The audience wasn't in much of a mood to find anything Mr. Picton said funny, but they couldn't help a few proud, satisfied smiles at his statement. Mr. Darrow also smiled, in a gracious sort of way, but his face went straight when, looking over toward Mr. Picton, he caught sight of Marcus. Quickly recovering, he made a quick motion what said he took his cap off to the detective sergeant for his clever bit of research work. Marcus smiled and saluted back as Mr. Darrow said,
"I thank the Honorable District Attorney, and I must say I'm impressed by his efforts to learn all about my reputation."
Mr. Picton, having seen the little exchange what had taken place between Mr. Darrow and Marcus, grinned.
"Mr. Darrow inflates me, Your Honor. He is perhaps unaware that I am only an assistant county prosecutor, District Attorney Pearson being as yet unwilling to quit his very fine suite of offices."
Putting on a puzzled face, what was so extreme as to make it plain that he actually knew exactly what Mr. Picton's rank was, Mr. Darrow scratched at his head.
"An assistant? Well, I beg the state's pardon.
I'm sure, Your Honor. I'd assume that in a capital case as fraught with importance as this one, the state would have wanted its senior officer to represent the people."
"As Your Honor knows, here in Boston we enjoy as few temperate weeks as do the citizens of Chicago," Mr. Picton answered, "and we did not wish to deprive Mr. Pearson of any of them. Since I was the investigating officer in this case, we felt safe entrusting it to my meager talents."
Judge Brown was nodding his head and looking a little annoyed.
"If you two gentlemen are finished needling each other," he said, "I'd like to see if we can't get a plea in this matter before noon. Mr. Darrow, the state having no objection, you are permitted to serve as primary counsel for your client in this court. I hope you don't regret the trip. Now then, Mrs. Hunter, you have heard the very grave charges against you. How do you plead?"
Looking to Libby Hatch, who was staring up at him anxiously, Mr. Darrow nodded.
Then Libby stood again, folded her hands before her, and said, "Not guilty, Your Honor." A wave of whispers went through the courtroom, bringing a bang from Judge Brown's gavel.
"Very well," he said, scowling around the room again. "Now, Mr. Picton, as to the matter of—"
The judge paused as he noticed Mr. Picton staring at Mr. Darrow with a puzzled face, one what was about as genuine as the bigger man's had been just a few seconds earlier.
"Mr. Picton, are you mesmerized, sir, by the learned counsel from Illinois?"
Shaking himself, Mr. Picton turned to the bench.
"Hm? Oh, I am sorry, Your Honor. I confess I wasn't aware that the defense had completed its plea."
"You find their plea inadequate, Mr. Picton?" the judge asked.
"It isn't for me to find it so, Your Honor," Mr. Picton answered. "I only thought that some sort of defining phrase might be attached to it, by reason of something or other, that sort of thing."
The judge stared down hard at him.
"Mr. Picton, you and I have done too much business in this room over the last few years for me to be unaware of what you're up to. But there's no jury here for you to vex with your suggestions yet, and I won't tolerate any playing to the galleries. Mr. Darrow is a qualified attorney who does not appear to suffer from any impediments of speech. If he wished to qualify the defendant's plea in any way, I'm sure he would have. Do you wish to so qualify the plea, Mr. Darrow?"
"Certainly not, Your Honor," Mr. Darrow said, in dark earnest. "The plea is a simple, straightforward, and absolute not guilty."
"Clear enough," Judge Brown replied. "In future, Mr. Picton, the state can keep its assumptions, as well as its hopes, to itself."
Mr. Picton just smiled and bowed.
"Now," the judge continued, "as to the matter of bail."
"Bail?"
Mr. Picton blurted out, getting a groan and another scowl from the judge.
"Yes, Mr. Picton," the old man said. "Bail, you are familiar with the practice?"
"In a case like this, I fear I am not, Your Honor," Mr. Picton replied. "The defendant is accused of the worst sort of violent assault on her own children, one of whom barely escaped with her life and is currently the state's principal witness. Does the court seriously intend that the state should even for a moment countenance the possibility of bail in this matter?"
"The court intends that the state should follow the rules of criminal procedure, whatever the offense," Judge Brown bellowed back. "I warn you, Mr. Picton, do not make any more efforts to get on my bad side so early in this trial. As you well know, it's a big place, my bad side, and once on it you may have trouble finding your way back over again."
Mr. Picton tried not to smile and nodded with what you might call pronounced respect.
"Yes, Your Honor, I ask the court's pardon. The state earnestly directs the court's attention to the severity of the crime with which the defendant is accused, and the danger that might be posed to the state's principal witness should the defendant be freed. We ask that bail in any amount be denied."
"Your Honor," Mr. Darrow countered, looking shocked, "my client is a respectable woman who endured the greatest tragedy that can be inflicted on a member of her sex. The savage murder before her eyes of two of her own children, and the attempted murder of a third."
"I beg the learned counsel's pardon," Mr. Picton answered with a hefty dose of sarcasm. "I was not aware that the issue had already been decided so conclusively. I thought that we were gathered together in this room to determine what, in fact, happened to the defendant's children."
Still scowling, Judge Brown nodded. "I'm afraid I must agree with the state here, Mr. Darrow. The burden may be on them to prove their allegations, but until they've failed, I cannot accept your assertion that Mrs. Hunter has endured any such tragedy, and I must ask you not to further inflame what is already a very emotional matter by making such statements. You have a request regarding bail?"
"We do, Your Honor," Mr. Darrow answered. "If indeed my client is guilty of violence against children, it'll be the first that this or any other state knows about it. Besides being a devoted mother, she's been a governess and a nurse to many children other than her own, and in that capacity has often behaved as heroically as she did on the night in question. We ask that you recognize that she is no threat either to the state's witnesses or to the community, and that, given the delicacy of both her sex and her nature, you post a reasonable bail to prevent her languishing in the county jail for the duration of what may be a protracted proceeding."
With the crowd, and those of us in the first two rows especially, waiting anxiously, Judge Brown rocked back in his chair, almost disappearing behind the bench. He stayed there for a minute or so, before sitting forward again. "The court appreciates Mr. Darrow's remarks concerning the gender and character of the defendant," he said slowly. "But it also notes that she is charged with a capital crime of a particularly violent and passionate nature. We regret any discomfort it may cause and shall instruct Sheriff Dunning to make every possible provision to ensure that Mrs. Hunter's stay in this building will be, if not a pleasant, then at least a bearable one. But bail itself is denied." That set the crowd mumbling again, and the judge went to work with the gavel. "I remind our guests of my earlier remarks," he said, "and I assure them that they were in earnest." With quiet restored, Judge Brown looked at the two tables below him. "We will reconvene on Tuesday morning at 9 o'clock for the purpose of beginning jury selection. But before we go, let me once more emphasize something to both sides in this case. The court is aware of the feelings aroused by this matter, and urges both of you to refrain from any blatant appeals to emotion or popular sentiment. It won't do either cause any good, and may injure your purposes beyond repair. Court is adjourned." Another bang of the gavel, and we all got to our feet as Judge Brown made his way back down to the door behind the bench, and then disappeared through it. As soon as he was gone, the room roared to life with conversation and comment again, particularly once Sheriff Dunning and Bailiff Coffey had guided Libby Hatch out through a side door, what led directly down to the cells in the basement of the building. Mr. Darrow gave her some words of encouragement on her way out, and she did her very best to look humble and grateful. But in her eyes, again, was that flirtatious, seductive glitter which she seemed unable to keep from flashing at men she'd only just met. After she'd gone, Mr. Darrow began to talk to Mr. Maxson, a conversation what Mr. Picton interrupted by marching himself straight over to their table and loudly declaring, "Well, Maxson, so you've got yourself some help. I'm not sure how I'd take that if I were you, though I suppose when the assistance comes from a man as thoroughly acquainted with as many areas of the law as Mr. Darrow, you can't object." He thrust out his hand. "Mr. Darrow, my name's Picton."
"Yes, I know," Mr. Darrow answered, shaking Mr. Picton's hand with a noticeable lack of enthusiasm and eyeing him in a way what was more than a little condescending.
"You see, I've heard about you too, Mr. Picton. Though I've got to say that my information came through slightly more," he cast an eye over at Marcus, "straightforward channels."
"Well, great men do as they will, lesser men do as they must," Mr. Picton answered lightly. "Where has Vanderbilt got you staying, Darrow? Somewhere comfortable, I trust? Not that Boston has many luxuries to offer, but perhaps you'll let me provide you with the odd meal at my house if you find you need it."
At the mention of Mr. Vanderbilt, Mr. Darrow looked at Mr. Picton in a way what went past condescension toward outright annoyance.
"I will hand it to you, Mr. Picton. There don't seem to be many aspects of this situation that have escaped your attention. Or does all of Boston Spa know the details of Mrs. Hunter's arrangements for her defense?"
"Oh, good God, no," Mr. Picton answered with a laugh. "And I wouldn't tell them if I were you. Judge Brown's attitude toward the citizens of our downstate metropolis is, I assure you, quite typical of the residents of this county. But you don't have to worry about me telling anyone. Wouldn't be sporting, would it?"
It was pretty easy to see that Mr. Picton was doing his best to irritate Mr. Darrow, and that he was succeeding. "I'm not sure sporting is a word I'd care to use in connection with a case as tragic as this one," Mr. Darrow mumbled back. "And I'm afraid I won't be able to take you up on your offer, as I'll be staying at the Grand Union Hotel in Saratoga. We'll be organizing our efforts from there."
Mr. Picton frowned at that one. He noised. "Well, I wouldn't let that bit get out either. People in Boston don't have much more use for Saratoga than they do for New York. They figure it's just a playground for rich strangers and their hired hands."
Mr. Darrow's eyes went wide with shock at that slap, but Mr. Picton just kept chattering away.
I hope you don't mind my being so free with advice, but I really do want to make sure that we keep the field as level as possible. Well, goodbye, Maxon. Best of luck. And, Darrow, if you change your mind about that meal, you will let me know, won't you?
By way of reply, Mr. Darrow rumbled something under his breath as he walked out through the gate in the railing with Mr. Maxon. Passing by our rows of seats, Mr. Darrow took our group in with a cold glare, but then, recognizing the doctor's face, he caught himself and turned around to approach the front row of chairs with a more friendly air.
"It's Dr. Kreischler, isn't it?" he said, the deep voice now becoming very genial. The doctor shook the hand what Mr. Darrow offered. "I'm a great admirer of your work, doctor, if you'll permit me to say so."
"I will," the doctor answered, studying the lawyer as he smiled engagingly. "Thank you, Mr. Darrow."
"Tell me, sir," Mr. Darrow went on, "is it true that you're acting as an advisor to the prosecution in this case?"
"That fact surprises you?" the doctor asked.
"I'll admit that it does," Mr. Darrow answered. "I wouldn't have thought you the kind of man to get involved in satisfying the state's desire to punish whatever person they could actually catch, just so they can write an end to this mysterious tragedy."
"Is that my motivation, Mr. Darrow?"
Shrugging his big shoulders, Mr. Darrow said, "I can't think of any other. And I've got to say, such behavior doesn't sound like you, but maybe I formed a wrong impression. Or maybe you've got your own reasons for doing business with the state of New York."
Seeing the doctor's eyes go a little wider at this barely disguised reference to the investigation into the Kreischler Institute's affairs, what was still going on in New York, Mr. Darrow smiled.
"Whatever the case, I hope we'll get a chance to talk at some point. Outside of court, I mean. I'm being wholly honest when I say that I admire what you do. What you generally do. Good morning."
The doctor nodded once, still smiling.
"Good morning to you, sir."
Mr. Darrow followed Mr. Maxon to the mahogany doors, where they were immediately buttonholed by Mr. Groves and a few other newspaper men who'd come down from Saratoga.
"Clever man," the doctor said, watching Mr. Darrow hold court with the journalists in a way which showed that the Chicago lawyer was very at home with the process.
"Oh, yes," Mr. Picton said, coming over to join us. "A clever, sanctimonious prig wrapped up in the broadcloth of the people."
Turning to pack up his briefcase, Mr. Picton laughed once, hard.
"One of the easiest kinds of people to irk."
"You are certainly doing your best, Rupert," Mr. Moore said with a shake of his head. "Do you want to spend this trial bickering with the man?"
"I'm sure the doctor will agree, John," Mr. Picton answered, sticking his unlit pipe into his mouth, "that when a man is perpetually irritated, he's far more likely to make errors of judgment than might otherwise be the case."
"Yes, I thought that was your purpose, Mr. Picton," the doctor answered, "and you achieved it admirably."
"Oh, nothing to it," Mr. Picton answered, tucking his briefcase under his arm. "Lawyers like that, as I have told you, generally think they have nothing to learn from Jesus Christ himself when it comes to being saviors with a mission. Annoying them is like falling off of a log, really. Well, the opening's gone well, but I'd like to regroup and go over our next set of steps, if it's all right with you, Doctor."
Taking out his watch again, Mr. Picton checked it.
"We can talk in my office, if you like."
"Of course," the doctor answered, leading the way up the aisle and around the little group of newspaper men who were still throwing questions at Mr. Darrow and Mr. Maxon. They tried to pull Mr. Picton aside, too, with questions what were pretty predictable. Wasn't the state's charging Libby Hatch an act of desperation? What possible motive could a mother have for killing her own kids? Wouldn't such a woman have to be insane? All that sort of stuff. But Mr. Picton was ready for it and very handily talked his way through the group without saying anything of importance, all the while referring them back to Mr. Darrow, who, he was sure, would have much more interesting things to say than any humble assistant county prosecutor. Once up in his office, Mr. Picton told the rest of us that his main concern at that point in the affair was to figure out just what kind of citizens would make the best jurors for the case and to assemble a set of questions what would separate such people from the rest of the candidates who would be called in. He asked the doctor's opinion on this matter and got a quick answer.
poor men, the doctor advised, preferably farmers, would be the best prospects, men who led tough lives and whose families were well acquainted with hard times. Such characters would best know just how easily personal conflicts and money concerns can lead to violence, even in a family what seems happy and peaceful on the outside. They likely would have seen or at least heard of women going after their own kids when things got especially discouraging or frustrating, and wouldn't have your more well-to-do man's opinions about the purity of female motives and actions. Mr. Picton said that he was relieved to hear all this, as it matched his own opinions perfectly. The trick now would be to find ways to identify such men without tipping Mr. Darrow off to the fact that he was doing it. As for the doctor,